طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح. طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly 45-minute segment of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program presents news and analysis from the Palestinian perspective, a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Fahm and continued in his memory by a group of his colleagues. This is John Roberts. This morning's entire program is devoted to my interview with Tufts University professor Tom Abode, whose new book, Colonial Jerusalem, has recently been released. If you want to understand what is happening to Jerusalem as we speak, and you want to view it through the eyes of an anthropologist, you want to read Tom's book. The Israeli narrative, which dominates the understanding of most Americans and virtually all of Congress, is a narrative based mostly on a false history fabricated by Israel to justify its theft of Palestinian land to build the Israeli state. It started before 1948. It continues today. Colonial Jerusalem tells the real story, and we need these kinds of accounts to puncture the Israeli fabrication with facts, historical facts. This book can be an important tool for those of us who care about this issue and are working to bring justice to the Palestinian people. It begins with telling the truth to the American people. So I urge you to read Colonial Jerusalem by Tom Abode, published by Syracuse University Press. Tom joins the so-called new historians such as Elam Pape in providing us with the real narrative, the real story, the facts, which speak for themselves. Here is my interview with Tufts University professor Tom Abode as we discuss his new book, Colonial Jerusalem. Tom, first of all, welcome to This Week in Palestine. I really appreciate your willingness to discuss your book, Colonial Jerusalem, with us.
Thank you, John. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
It's an important, well-constructed literary portrait of what is happening to Jerusalem under Israeli occupation that continues what so-called new historians have begun, the deconstruction of the Israeli narrative, which is steeped in what I call myth and mendacity. However, your view was through the eyes of an anthropologist rather than an historian, and that's what made the book unique for me. It bring to life the people issues, and I think that's the importance of the book. So perhaps the best way to begin is with a kind of overview of what you're trying to do with this book.
Yes. Well, thanks again, John, for having me on. I intended in this book to show what everyday life was like in Jerusalem, in contemporary Jerusalem, under Israeli military occupation, one of the longest ongoing military occupations in the world, actually, and began not in 1967, but in fact in 1948, when Israel conquered about 70% of historic Palestine from the indigenous Palestinian population, and in that year took over West Jerusalem, what we today call the West Side of Jerusalem, or West Jerusalem, and emptied its that part of Jerusalem of its 35,000 Palestinians, almost completely emptied it of the non-Jewish population, and then took over the homes and land that belonged to the Palestinians in West Jerusalem in 1967. So the book looks at those earlier years, what life was like before the establishment of Israel, what Arab-Jewish relations were like before the establishment of Israel in 48, which were very different than they are today. There was much more mixing among Jews, Arabs, Christians, Muslims, And Israel, since 48, has made that very difficult. Israel's become one of the most segregated societies, and I dare say one of the most racist societies in the world. I mean, the kind of discrimination against Palestinians that you see there is very similar to South Africa, very similar to the Jim Crow South. So,
yes, de jure. It's written right into the laws.
That's right.
And the policies, I mean, they're really quite out front about it.
They really are, and that manifests itself in the questions of land and housing, which is this book is seeking to look at. What are some of the politics around urban space, the politics of land, Israeli land law, and how that affects Palestinians, how this conflict is a conflict over land and a conflict over housing and familial space. And so the book seeks to look over the last several decades at how Israeli power has constructed a particular kind of Jerusalem and organized a particular kind of city that benefits Israeli Jews to the exclusion of Palestinian Christians, Muslims, and others. So it's a, as you say, an ethnographic study, an anthropological study, not so much from a bird's eye view, a cartographer's view, but from a sort of a street level view of daily life in a city with real human beings as protagonists in this this national drama. And so I sought to do that with a particular focus because Jerusalem is so crucial to both Israelis and Palestinians' national sense of selves. It's not, the book does not argue that it's only the city's only significant to Palestinians or that only Palestinians have claims there at all. It is, though, an effort to show how Israel as the dominant party, as the occupying force, has created a situation where Palestinian claims are negated in favor of Israeli claims, in favor of the rights of Israelis who might have just moved to Israel last week. They have more, by virtue of being an Israeli Jew, a new Jewish resident in the city, they have more rights to that land and sometimes Palestinian homes than a Palestinian family who've been there for generations. So I wanted to unpack that a little bit and speak against the dominant discourses in the U.S. mainstream media, which, if you listen to them solely, you wouldn't have any sense that Jerusalem is meaningful to Palestinians or that it's a city that's largely been taken from Palestinians in the last six decades.
And continues. I mean,
yes.
I always look at this as, Israel talks about its willingness, to quote, share the land at some point, et cetera. But really the Zionist dream from 1897 or whatever was to take the land.
Yes.
And so that's really what's at the heart of this thing. And I just, I don't believe for a minute that Israel wants Palestinians to have a state at all. Mm-hmm. And that all of these peace processes, all of the, everything that goes on, Oslo, etc., is to buy time. Is to buy time. They never want to deal with the defining borders or anything. It's just like, deal with that later. Buy time, buy time, buy time. And when you have time, you can do what they're doing. You can, you can, take East Jerusalem. You can build the settlements, etc. So, talk a little bit about how that's happening.
Yes.
In Jerusalem, the kinds of the way they do it, and how it affects the people that live there.
Sure. So, well, since 1967, Israel has conquered and held East Jerusalem and the rest of the West Bank in violation of international law. In 1967 and the months after, the United Nations asked Israel to leave, and the United States paid for Israel to stay. And so you have a situation in East Jerusalem. I talked a little bit about the theft of Palestinian land and homes in West Jerusalem. But since 1967, Israel has sought to reconfigure East Jerusalem such that they create a demographic dominance over the Palestinians in East Jerusalem. So they've established about nine major settlements, illegal settlements in East Jerusalem, which now today house 200,000 Jewish settlers. These are settlers who are living on largely land stolen from the Palestinians. This is internationally recognized, even by the U.S. State Department, officially as occupied territory, East Jerusalem. Now, the U.S. government doesn't live by that, their statements. They allow Israel to continue to build settlements. But there's a vast international consensus. Almost just about every country in the world acknowledges that East Jerusalem is occupied territory, just as Hebron is, as Nablus and Ramallah is, and the Jordan Valley are. So Israel has sought since 1967 to both the guiding principle. I interviewed in this, for this book, a number of Israeli urban planners, people who are actually involved in the what I call the colonization of Jerusalem, and some of them became, their politics shifted over the last decades when they saw what their own government was doing in the way of discriminatory land policy and violence toward the Palestinians. And the guiding principle that many of the Israeli planners themselves claim was the guiding principle of the Israeli state was to take a maximum amount of land, Palestinian land, while retaining a minimum number of Palestinian people on that land.
Right.
So boundaries were redrawn such that the Israeli state unilaterally redrew the boundaries of Jerusalem and took in land that had never been part of Jerusalem and was in fact owned privately by Palestinians, but kept the people who owned that land outside of the borders of these new... It was a very gerrymandered sort of situation that we in the United States are familiar with historically and in contemporary times. So it was this guiding principle that had a lot to do with racial policy, with keeping the wrong kind of people out of the Jewish state. This is, I don't think, too incendiary of a way to describe it. These are the ways in which Israeli government officials and planners have talked about it, and settlers have talked about it. This is our land. God gave it to us. And that is our interpretation of the Bible, and the Palestinians can go live somewhere else.
Yeah, it's a great strategy to take Jerusalem and then define Jerusalem as literally from Ramallah to Bethlehem and halfway to Jericho.
That's right.
You know, you make your claim for Jerusalem, then you define it as this huge piece of the country.
That's right.
And and put in place laws and policies that prohibit most Palestinians from going to Jerusalem unless you Jerusalem residency. And you know, that's another whole story how people can't go there.
That's right.
So that the it's just one of the separation policies that, you know, and prohibit intermarriage, prohibit... It's an incredible... And they, you know, they always claim that this is not... apartheid is not the right word, but apartheid is exactly the right word. It is a system of laws that creates separateness.
That's right.
Puts it into law.
The noted political activist and philosopher Noam Chomsky, who you and many of your listeners are quite well aware of, has actually said that in the West Bank, in East Jerusalem, apartheid is actually too weak of a word to describe, because at least under apartheid, the South African government sort of, they needed the African laborers, the non-white laborers, and they wanted to keep them in Bantustans, and they pumped money into those Bantustans. Israel's colonial vision is to just get rid of the Palestinians. They don't want to necessarily even exploit their labor. They want them gone. And they're doing quite a number of things to try to create that reality. So, but I'm satisfied with the apartheid analogy, and Nelson Mandela and Bishop Tutu, when they went to Palestine and Israel, Bishop Tutu notably said, this looks very much like the kind of racist regime we blacks lived under.
He said it was worse at one point. He said, well,
yes, and Jimmy Carter has said similar things. So it's not an incendiary. I don't think it's to dramatically inflate the racial, demographic, and colonial dimensions of this rule. And many is, you know, there are a number of Israelis. What I want to emphasize in this book, my book Colonial Jerusalem, is that I learned so much. I've talked to you about this before, John, from Israeli progressives who are critical of their own government and who are at the forefront of unearthing what the vision of this government is with regard to the land and the people. And so it's not the world against Israel. It's there are many Israeli dissidents who are speaking out against their policies, just as we Americans speak out against our own government's policies abroad and at home. So, yes, I think Jerusalem is very crucial because it is the one part of the territories occupied in 1967 that the Israelis have stated just explicitly that they will never cede to the Palestinians, explicitly. And with the rise of the Oslo Accords in the early 90s, what you had was, yes, this process that was touted as a peace process, but an increasing, I mean, what went along with Oslo was this increasing enforced segregation and envelopment of Jerusalem such that Palestinians in the city who were living under Israeli occupation in the city's lives more and more difficult. The settlement expansion increased under the Oslo Accords. The settler population in Jerusalem doubled, and the settler population in the rest of the West Bank almost tripled. Or nearly tripled. And so, as you just said, John, what's important is that Israeli governments, left, right, and center, have always been willing to negotiate and talk. But as many believe, only to buy time and so they can change the facts on the ground.
That's right.
These negotiations would have been very different if we got a settlement freeze. Or if, you know, as the Palestinian sociologist Salim Tamari has said, we Palestinians are willing to accept a relatively long interim period in which these things are worked out, provided that Israel doesn't change the status on the ground.
Yeah.
But they have used negotiations or talking as a way to buy time to create facts on the ground. And they have.
And have now made it impossible for any kind of two-state solution. I mean, to try to, with a straight face, talk about a two-state solution when they've carved that land up. And I mean, when you think of trying to empty 200,000 settlers.
It's not looking good, I must admit. There are different views on this, but I do think that if we haven't reached that point where it's the two-state solution is impossible, we're getting very, very close to that moment. I mean, others who argue a different perspective say, well, these settlers can always be, this land can be decolonized. The settlers, through various means, can be compelled to go back within Israel's internationally recognized borders. I'm agnostic about it myself.
Well, there are sort of economic settlers, people that go there because they get really good housing deals, and then there's the ideologues. It's the ideologues that are the problem, going to be the problem,
sure.
and there's a fair number.
No, that's right. That's right.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about how when I was there last time. We visited a family in Sheikh Jarrah, in an area that is being taken over.
Yes, in East Jerusalem.
In East Jerusalem, and we visited a family where the family was still in part of the house, but literally settlers had taken over a part of their house and sort of and eventually took over all of it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what's happening in this little. This little area in Sheikh Jarrah.
Mm-hmm.
It's incredible how they're doing it. I mean, it's not only that they're doing it, but how they're doing it. And you talk about in your book about how this is being done.
Yes, there are not a small number of deeply, as you say, ideologically driven Jewish settlers who are part of organizations that are largely funded by right-wing extremists in the United States, Christian Zionists and groups like the Friends of the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, and Atarot Kohanim, these other right-wing religious extremist organizations in the United States. And they fund these settlers to try to buy up Palestinian properties through subterfuge, by going to them with front groups and offering them big sums of money. And when that doesn't work, sometimes often just taking over the Palestinian home. This has happened on dozens, if not hundreds, of occasions in the last 30 or 40 years in East Jerusalem. The old city's full of Palestinian homes, several dozen, if not over 100 homes have been taken over by these kind of right-wing settlers. And the Israeli government sometimes encourages them and always does nothing to stop them.
And protects them.
Exactly. And so you saw in Sheikh Jarrah, these very settlers who've taken over Palestinian homes have a 24-hour a day security service that sits on top of the home, armed to protect these settlers. So this is unbearable for Palestinians who live under this. They're being really, Israelis talk about terrorism. They're terrorizing the Palestinians every hour of every day through these kind of means. People never knowing when the settlers. And I was there a couple years ago on a Fulbright scholarship teaching at Beit Zeit University in the West Bank, and I was informed by the U.S. consulate that there are security issues here. One of which is that the Jewish settlers are on the rampage, and there's been a threefold increase in settler violence against Palestinians and others, foreigners who get in the way of their designs on the land. No, it's reached very dire conditions, and no one can argue that the conditions on the ground for Palestinians has gotten much worse over the last 20 years. There's no doubt.
Yeah.
It's gotten worse in many different respects. And this book tries to show different ways in which that's so.
Well, in the book goes back 48, pre-48, how it was beginning in West Jerusalem. That's the story of the Bishurit home and the Sa'id home and how they're taken over. And to read that is just jarring. And when you think here the United States is the great protector and we worship private property here, and yet we sit by and allow this theft, and there's no other word for it, to go on. But they, they simply took over these homes. Of course, 48 people went out and they took them over and never ever gave
them go back.
I think your book's important because it does deconstruct the myth. And what we need to do, I think, here in the United States is get people to understand the facts. Because this stuff is all steeped in a lot of it, as I say, in mythology. And a great deal of it is having to do with this mixing of religion, nationalism, and identity.
That's right.
So that religion becomes history. I mean, the Bible becomes history. And so you get into that, and you talk about. Tell us about the King David.
That's very interesting. Yes, you're absolutely right, John. There are a series of myths that are not so much biblical or national, but sort of a merging of nationalist myths about Israeli connections to the land and biblical myths that many Israelis believe give them the right to all of Palestine and beyond, as a particular reading of the Bible. The major myth that's relevant to biblical myth or biblical story that's relevant to Jerusalem is the King David idea and the history that Israel attributes to King David and his rule over the city, or his supposed rule over the city several thousand years ago. As I mentioned, the book, it's important to know that Israeli archaeologists and other archaeologists will tell you that there's very little evidence for the King David narrative. Outside of the stories in the Bible and the religious stories, there's very little evidence that King David existed as we have come to know him. But out of this myth, or this historical mythical convergence, a whole national mythology has been built up in Israel about how Jerusalem belongs to the Jewish people because King David once ruled there 3,000 years ago. And this is a flawed understanding of history. I mean, the Bible has historical dimensions to it, of course. There are historical figures in it, but it's not a historical text like a history of the 18th century in Europe.
Right.
And I know you and your listeners understand that. It's not to dismiss people's sacred understandings and religious connections. It's just to say that you can't use any religious text to justify contemporary forms of land theft or apartheid. And that's what Israel is doing. So the King David myth has become so outlandish that you now have Jewish settlers today in the city looking for the place where King David supposedly once ruled. And if they determine that Palestinians are living on that land, they will actively, violently take their homes in the name of reestablishing the kingdom of King David, or the
right. Well, the so-called City of David, which is now right. Silwan, right. They're excavating. They're doing all kinds of things in the name of King David, and you know that's going to become, you know, you say that's going to become the pretext to take mm-hmm. to take this whole area
yes.
away.
It's happening. It's happening now.
Yeah.
And as you mentioned before, the Israeli government, whether they believe in this or not, they're actively supporting and funding and protecting these settlers to engage in this. Most of these settlers are Americans who were not, I should be careful, maybe not most, but the largest single group of fanatical settlers are American, often from New York and Boston and Chicago, big cities here, and some of them, their Hebrew isn't even as good as the Palestinians who live there. These are recent immigrants, and yet they are making claims to Palestinian land based on what their reading of the Bible and the Torah. I mean, it's a bizarre and ridiculous and an unbearable and untenable situation for the Palestinians, and really quite damaging, I think, to the Jewish people and to Israelis as well, I would argue. I think this behavior is not... to support this is not to support Israel. I actually think it's quite damaging to Israel yeah. to support these kind of people, these kind of factions, and this kind of fanaticism.
And then they use the Western Wall
yes.
as the wall left from King David's...
Well, it's the Second Temple, the Herodian Temple.
The Second Temple. But tell us about the Moroccan Quarter and what happened and how they... I mean, this is a wonderful illustration of both how they're using religion to claim land mm-hmm. and the way they're going about it. This mm-hmm. this is a particularly distressing story, I think.
Yes.
I'd love to have you tell that.
Sure. I devoted a whole chapter to it in the book. And it involves the Western Wall area, which if those who visit the city today will see in front of the Western Wall of the remains of the Herodian Second Temple from about 2,000 years ago when the Romans destroyed it. That wall remained, and it remains a very sacred site in Judaism. Jews go and pray there. And if you go there, you will see that the place of devotion. This is in East Jerusalem, mind you, in the Old City. And until 1967, there existed... before the wall, not right up into the wall, but about 15 feet into the wall, there existed before the wall a small place of prayer, and then an 800-year-old Palestinian Arab neighborhood called the Moroccan Quarter, which was built in the 12th century to house Muslim pilgrims, mostly from Morocco and North Africa, who had come to Jerusalem to live. And it was built supposedly by the son of Salah ad-Din. And that neighborhood existed in that vicinity for about 700-800 years. And then in 1967, soon after Israel conquered East Jerusalem and the rest of the West Bank, among the very first things they did was, one night after nightfall, move bulldozers and destroy this neighborhood, this 700-year-old neighborhood, kick out the 1,000 residents who are all Palestinian Muslims and Christians, and level the place entirely. And they did that to create this large plaza area before the wall, which would allow many thousands of Israelis and Israeli Jews and tourists to come and visit the wall.
In a moment, you will hear introductions.
And created that space as a place not only of religious devotion, but of national significance. Now, under international law, Israel, as the occupying power, had no right to turn one stone there. I mean, they had no right to change the status of that area. Israel claims this is the eternal capital of the Jewish people. We don't care about international law. We don't care about international opinion or UN declarations. But in fact, that act was the first illegal act under Israeli rule that happened within the first week of its occupation in 67, before there were any settlers.
Within days,
a week.
Yeah.
And so those Palestinians were just sort of pushed out, and they fled into the darkness, and their homes and everything they owned were destroyed. They were given an hour or two's notice to get out, this after nightfall, and then they were dragged out. If those who didn't leave were dragged out, and their homes were destroyed. This is well documented by Israeli historians. So people go to the Western Wall today, and I don't deny its religious significance to Israelis and to Jews. That's important to understand. But they've created a situation where they've negated the rights and the histories of other people for whom that area is also important. And that is a metaphor for what has been done by the Israeli state for several decades to another people who have claims to the land and religious significance and ties to the land. And the Moroccan Quarter is very emblematic in that way. I'm trying to think what else. So what I was trying to say, and John, when you visited there, you could probably see it. You probably knew the history already. But many people who go to the Western Wall today don't understand that. In fact, they're treading over the land of a former neighborhood that was ethnically cleansed by the Jewish state in 67. And very few people, even some Palestinians, don't even know this. Palestinians who are younger, who weren't alive then, don't even know what happened there.
Yeah, what's interesting about your book, the cover, is a photograph. It's a photograph of the Moroccan Quarter before it was, plowed under.
Yes.
And then on the back of the book is a photo of the way it is today. And, all you need to do is put those photos side by side.
Yes.
This is the story.
Yeah.
It's wonderful to see that. It's so graphic. I think that was great for them.
Well, thank you.
The way it was done was great.
Thank you.
Let's talk a little bit about how Israel defines certain properties as absentee. Mm-hmm. They drive people out, and then when the house is not occupied, they declare it absentee owners.
Yes.
And then they've created this Jewish land...
Jewish National Fund?
Jewish National Fund. Mm-hmm. It sort of takes over this and claims it in the name of Israel. And,
yes.
Talk a little bit about the way that whole thing...
Sure.
The use of absentee ownership is being used to justify the taking of their property.
Yes, this is an important point, and it gets us back to 1948 when the year Israel was established, and the year about 750,000 Palestinians were driven off their land or fled in fear. These former residents left the country or were driven out, and those who the more privileged members of the Palestinian community often left before the War of 48 began, because they had the means to go. Some of them, like the Saeeds and Edward Said's family and others, had homes in other countries like Egypt or Lebanon. So they saw this war coming, and they said, "We'll lock the house. We'll take some belongings, and we'll leave for a couple weeks. And when the war's over, we'll come back." Well, they never were allowed to come back. And having fled or been driven out, this new Israeli legal system that was imposed on the land stated that any Palestinian who left in 1948 to what they call an enemy country, quote-unquote, it could be Egypt, Jordan, Lebanon, all the countries where the Palestinians fled, they lost the right to their land. Their land then became, their private property was transferred and legally and became absentee property, quote-unquote. And absentee property, by the terms of the Israeli legal system, then falls into the hands of the Israeli state, which then can redefine it as Israeli land, state land, which makes it off limits by law to non-Jews. So these properties, and there were thousands of them in just the Jerusalem area alone, thousands, hundreds of thousands of of Palestinian properties, lands, and homes that were taken under this legal ruse. And these families, 67 years later, still cannot get their land back. And it is a way in which Israel transferred, excuse me, in 1948, the Jewish population, the Zionist population of what was then Palestine, owned about 8% of the entire country. They tried to buy up more land from the Palestinians, most of whom refused to sell their land. So then in 1948, the new Jewish state tried to do militarily what it couldn't do commercially, and they took over this land by force through the method I just described and other means, took land and homes of Palestinians and settled new Israeli immigrants in these homes, which they reserved for Jewish use only. And the Palestinians were suddenly, it was kind of an emotional torture, because at the time they thought, oh, well, eventually we'll go back.
Yeah.
And for years they thought, well, maybe we'll go back. And now they realize they've lost everything and they can't go back. And they can go back maybe as tourists, if Israel allows them back into the country as a tourist visa. And many, as I relate in the book, have gone back to their old homes, knocked on the door, and confronted the Israelis who are living in the home now, who claim it is their home. And they can do that, and sometimes often they're met with very nice Israeli residents who are very kind and pleasant to them, but who talk about the home as, you know, this is our home now. It's not your home. And this, it seems to me, there can't really be peace between Israelis and Palestinians in the future if there's going to be a peace without this issue being dealt with. We can't just talk about the 67 territories. Palestinian refugees have rights under international law and UN declarations, and exiles who've been made homeless in 48. It's not acceptable that a future arrangement or agreement be made where these refugees and these properties are not returned to the Palestinians, or these people are compensated with an acknowledgement that Israel has to accept some responsibility for making them refugees and exiles. It just seems to me that you can't have any tenable peace between Israelis and Palestinians until this is acknowledged and dealt with, as the Israelis would demand if it were done to them.
No, absolutely. I always say, you put the shoe on the other foot, and you're...
Yes.
One interesting story, I think it was the Bishoret home that you talk about, at one point they left, and the British, the mandate, was that the house where the Brits put someone in the house?
Yeah, it had been rented by the Royal Air Force because of its strategic purpose. And then in 48, as the British were withdrawing, they basically handed over the keys to the Haganah, the Israeli military, the budding Israeli, nascent Israeli army. And they took over the house, and the family had already left the country and fled the war. And so Israel appropriated the house that way, and it had become the residence of many famous Israelis.
Well, which is really incredible when you think about it, that in a sense the Bishoritz rented, or
yes,
to the British,
yes,
under the mandate, and then when the war comes,
yes,
the British don't turn it back to the rightful owner.
Yes.
You know, they turn it over to,
yes,
to Israel, and of course,
yes,
you know, we read history, we know the fix was in, but that was particularly galling to me to read.
Yes.
Oh my God, they, you know, the involvement on it was.
Yes, it. You know, the British internally, if you read the archives, part of this book is based on a reading of the British colonial archives and what they were thinking at that time about what should be done with their colony, Palestine. And the British were actually of many different minds on it. Some were committed Zionists and wanted a Jewish state to be established on all or most of Palestine. Others were very lukewarm about the creation of a Jewish state, and there were others even who opposed it and said there should be one state for Jews, Muslims, Christians, one Palestine united, and that a Jewish state established on a land where only 8% of the land was owned by Zionist and Jews would be would ensure a conflict between the peoples there. But when Britain left, they in the main turned over control of their military bases and their land to the Zionists, not to the Palestinians.
Right, and all along, often telling the Palestinians quite, you know, the same thing that they were telling the Israelis, and yeah. You know, the Palestinians, you know, were really done in by this,
yes,
by this mendacity of the Brits, that all along,
absolutely
knew where they were going to tilt, but certainly didn't reveal their hand.
Yes,
yeah,
that's certainly the case.
Well, Tom, thanks. I've run out of time. Thank you for this book.
Oh, thank you.
And we have to get people to read it, because you can read this book, you'll come to understand really what's going on there. And Americans don't understand it, because yes. it's so steeped in this mythology, and yes. you hear it in the talking points of the politicians, mm-hmm. and it's just very, very aggravating. So I think our job is get people to understand what really happened, what's really going on. Let the facts speak, demythologize, deconstruct this.
Yes.
And that's exactly what you do in this book.
Oh, well, thank you so much. Those are very kind words. I appreciate your assessment of my book. It's very nice. Thank you, John.
Thanks, Tom.
That was Professor Tom Abode discussing his recently released book, Colonial Jerusalem, published by Syracuse University Press. I again urge you to read this book. We need to understand and communicate to others what is really going on in Jerusalem if we are to effect change in Israel-Palestine. Colonial Jerusalem is a great resource for those of us who wish to take on that task. That is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine. You can hear us every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. on WZBC 90.3 FM, or you can stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org if you are out of the limited range of the radio signal. Just click on Listen on the homepage. If you want to hear us at another time, go to the WZBC homepage, click on WZBC Archive, go to 8 a.m. Sunday, and click on Listen. The programs are on this archive for 2 weeks. Want to hear back broadcasts of This Week in Palestine? Thanks to Stan Robinson, who meticulously archives all broadcasts of the program, you can find our past programs at www.archive.org. On the home page, simply type This Week in Palestine in the search box, and voila, you will get a listing of back broadcasts. That is www.archive.org. Simply type This Week in Palestine in the search box. Try it. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.